Chapter 10. Most of the 30 or so little tables covered by red cloths with a white design stood ranged at right angles to the deep brown wainscoting of the underground hall. Bronze chandeliers with many globes depended from the low, slightly vaulted ceiling, and the fresco paintings ran flat and dull all round the walls without windows, representing scenes of the chase and of outdoor revelry in medieval costumes. Varlets in green jerkins brandished hunting knives and raised on high tankards of foaming beer. Unless I am very much mistaken, you are the man who would know the inside of this confounded affair, said the robust Ossipon, leaning over, his elbows far out on the table, and his feet tucked back completely under his chair. His eyes stared with wild eagerness. An upright semi-grand piano near the door, flanked by two palms in pots, executed suddenly all by itself a valse tune with aggressive virtuosity. The din it raised was deafening. When it ceased, as abruptly as it had started, the bespectacled, dingy little man who faced Ossipon behind a heavy glass mug full of beer emitted calmly what at the sound of a general proposition. In principle, what one of us may or may not know, as to any given fact, can't be a matter for inquiry to the others. Certainly not, Comrade Ossipon agreed in a quiet undertone. In principle. With his big florid face held between his hands, he continued to stare hard, while the dingy little man in spectacles coolly took a drink of beer and stood the glass mug back on the table. His flat, large ears departed widely from the sides of his skull, which looked frail enough for Ossipon to crush between thumb and forefinger. The dome of the forehead seemed to rest on the rim of the spectacles. The flat cheeks, of a greasy, unhealthy complexion, were merely smudged by the miserable poverty of a thin dark whisker. The lamentable inferiority of the whole physique was made ludicrous by the supremely self-confident bearing of the individual. His speech was curt, and he had a particularly impressive manner of keeping silent. Ossipon spoke again from between his hands in a mutter. Have you been out much today? No. I stayed in bed all the morning, answered the other. I? Oh. Nothing, said Ossipon, gazing earnestly and quivering inwardly with the desire to find out something, but obviously intimidated by the little man's overwhelming air of unconcern. When talking with his comrade, which happened, but rarely, the big Ossipon suffered from a sense of moral and even physical insignificance. However, he ventured another question. Did you walk down here? No, omnibus, the little man answered readily enough. He lived far away in Islington, in a small house down a shabby street, littered with straw and dirty paper, where out of school hours a troop of assorted children ran and squabbled with a shrill, joyless, rowdy clamor. His single back room, remarkable for having an extremely large cupboard, he rented furnished from two elderly spinsters, dressmakers in a humble way with a clientele of servant girls mostly. He had a heavy padlock put on the cupboard, but otherwise he was a model lodger, giving no trouble, and requiring practically no attendance. His oddities were that he insisted on being present when his room was being swept, and that when he went out he locked his door and took the key away with him. Ossipon had a vision of these round black-rimmed spectacles progressing along the streets on the top of an omnibus, their self-confident glitter falling here and there on the walls of houses, or lowered upon the heads of the unconscious stream of people on the pavements. The ghost of a sickly smile altered the set of Ossipon's thick lips at the thought of the walls nodding, of people running for life at the sight of those spectacles. If they had only known. What a panic! He murmured interrogatively. Colin been sitting long here? An hour or more, answered the other negligently, and took a pull at the dark beer. All his movements, the way he grasped the mug, the act of drinking, the way he set the heavy glass down, and folded his arms had a firmness, an assured precision which made the big and muscular Ossipon, leaning forward with staring eyes and protruding lips, look the picture of eager indecision. An hour, he said. And maybe you haven't heard yet the news I've heard just now in the street. Have you? The little man shook his head negatively the least bit. But as he gave no indication of curiosity, Usipin ventured to add that he had heard it just outside the place. A newspaper boy had yelled the thing under his very nose, and not being prepared for anything of that sort, he was very much startled and upset. He had to come in there with a dry mouth. Never thought of finding you here, he added, murmuring steadily, with his elbows planted on the table. I come here sometimes, said the other, preserving his provoking coolness of demeanor. It's wonderful that you of all people should have heard nothing of it, the big Usipin continued. His eyelids snapped nervously upon the shining eyes. Who of all people, he repeated tentatively. This obvious restraint argued an incredible and inexplicable timidity of the big fellow before the calm little man, who again lifted the glass mug, drank, and put it down with brusque and assured movements. And that was all. Usipin, after waiting for something, word or sign, that did not come, made an effort to assume a sort of indifference. Do you, he said, deadening his voice still more, give your stuff to anybody who's up to asking you for it? My absolute rule is never to refuse anybody, as long as I have a pinch by me, answered the little man with decision. That's a principle? Commented Usipin. It's a principle. And you think it's sound? The large round spectacles, which gave a look of staring self-confidence to the sallow face, confronted Usipin like sleepless unwinking orbs flashing a cold fire. Perfectly. Always. Under every circumstance. What could stop me? Why should I not? Why should I think twice about it? Usipin gasped, as it were, discreetly. Do you mean to say you would hand it over to a tech if one came to ask you for your wares? The other smiled faintly. Let them come and try it on, and you will see, he said. They know me, but I know also every one of them. They won't come near me, not they. His thin, livid lips snapped together firmly. Usipin began to argue. But they could send someone rig a plant on you. Don't you see? Get the stuff from you in that way, and then arrest you with the proof in their hands. Proof of what? Dealing in explosives without a license, perhaps. This was meant for a contemptuous jeer, though the expression of the thin, sickly face remained unchanged, and the utterance was negligent. Don't think there's one of them anxious to make that arrest. I don't think they could get one of them to apply for a warrant. I mean one of the best. Not one. Why? Usipin asked. Because they know very well I take care never to part with the last handful of my wares. I've it always by me. He touched the breast of his coat lightly. And a thick glass flask, he added. So I have been told, said Usipin, with a shade of wonder in his voice. But I didn't know if they know, interrupted the little man crisply, leaning against the straight chair back, which rose higher than his fragile head. I shall never be arrested. The game isn't good enough for any policeman of them all. To deal with a man like me you require sheer, naked, inglorious heroism. Again his lips closed with a self-confident snap. Usipin repressed a movement of impatience. Or recklessness or simply ignorance, he retorted. Hey, of only to get somebody for the job who does not know you carry enough stuff in your pocket to blow yourself and everything within 60 yards of you to pieces. I never affirmed I could not be eliminated, rejoined the other. But that wouldn't be an arrest. Moreover, it's not so easy as it looks. Bah! Usipin contradicted. Aren't be too sure of that. What's to prevent half a dozen of them jumping upon you from behind in the street? With your arms pinned to your sides you could do nothing, could you? Yes, I could. I am seldom out in the streets after dark, said the little man impassively, and never very late. I walk always with my right hand closed round the india rubber ball which I have in my trouser pocket. The pressing of this ball actuates a detonator inside the flask I carry in my pocket. It's the principle of the pneumatic instantaneous shutter for a camera lens. The tube leads up. With a swift disclosing gesture, he gave Ossipon a glimpse of an india rubber tube, resembling a slender brown worm, issuing from the armhole of his waistcoat and plunging into the inner breast pocket of his jacket. His clothes, of a nondescript brown mixture, were threadbare and marked with stains, moldy in the folds, with ragged buttonholes. The detonator is partly mechanical, partly chemical, he explained, with casual condescension. It is instantaneous, of course, murmured Ossipon, with a slight shudder. Far from it, confessed the other, with a reluctance which seemed to twist his mouth dolorously. Full 20 seconds must elapse from the moment I press the ball till the explosion takes place. Phew! Whistled Ossipon, completely appalled. 20 seconds? Horrors! You mean to say that you could face that? I should go crazy, wouldn't matter if you did. Of course, it's the weak point of this special system, which is only for my own use. The worst is that the manner of exploding is always the weak point with us. I am trying to invent a detonator that would adjust itself to all conditions of action, and even to unexpected changes of conditions. A variable and yet perfectly precise mechanism. A really intelligent detonator. 20 seconds, muttered Ossipon again. Ugh. And then, with a slight turn of the head, the glitter of the spectacle seemed to gauge the size of the beer saloon in the basement of the renowned Silenus restaurant. Nobody in this room could hope to escape, was the verdict of that survey. Or yet this couple going up the stairs now. The piano at the foot of the staircase clanged through a mazurka with brazen impetuosity, as though a vulgar and impudent ghost were showing off. The keys sank and rose mysteriously. Then all became still. For a moment Ossipon imagined the overlighted place changed into a dreadful black hole belching horrible fumes choked with ghastly rubbish of smashed brickwork and mutilated corpses. He had such a distinct perception of ruin and death that he shuddered again. The other observed, with an air of calm sufficiency. In the last instance, it is character alone that makes for one's safety. There are very few people in the world whose character is as well established as mine. I wonder how you managed it, growled Ossipon. Force of personality, said the other, without raising his voice, and coming from the mouth of that obviously miserable organism, the assertion caused the robust Ossipon to bite his lower lip. Force of personality, he repeated, with ostentatious calm. Have the means to make myself deadly, but that by itself, you understand, is absolutely nothing in the way of protection. What is effective is the belief those people have in my will to use the means. That's their impression. It is absolute. Therefore I am deadly. There are individuals of character amongst that lot too, muttered Ossipon ominously. Possibly. But it is a matter of degree obviously, since, for instance, I am not impressed by them. Therefore they are inferior. They cannot be otherwise. Their character is built upon conventional morality. It leans on the social order. Mine stands free from everything artificial. They are bound in all sorts of conventions. They depend on life, which, in this connection, is a historical fact surrounded by all sorts of restraints and considerations, a complex organized fact open to attack at every point, whereas I depend on death, which knows no restraint, and cannot be attacked. My superiority is evident. This is a transcendental way of putting it, said Ossipon, watching the cold glitter of the round spectacles. I've heard Carl Jung say much the same thing not very long ago. Carl Jung, mumbled the other contemptuously, the delegate of the International Red Committee, has been a posturing shadow all his life. There are three of you delegates, aren't there? I won't define the other two, as you are one of them. But what you say means nothing. You are the worthy delegates for revolutionary propaganda, but the trouble is not only that you are as unable to think independently as any respectable grocer or journalist of them all, but that you have no character whatever. Ossipon could not restrain a start of indignation. But what do you want from us? He exclaimed in a deadened voice. What is it you are after yourself? A perfect detonator, was the peremptory answer. What are you making that face for? You see, you can't even bear the mention of something conclusive. I am not making a face, growled the annoyed Ossipan bearishly. You revolutionizes, the other continued, with leisurely self-confidence, are the slaves of the social convention, which is afraid of you, slaves of it as much as the very police that stands up in the defense of that convention. Clearly you are, since you want to revolutionize it. It governs your thought, of course, and your action too, and thus neither your thought nor your action can ever be conclusive. He paused, tranquil, with that air of close, endless silence, then almost immediately went on. You are not a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.